Good evening. James McCanny here with My Science Hour, January 12, 2012. And yes, at last, 2012. But I don't know what's going to happen this year. I would just say stay on your toes. That's my best advice. Don't just be prepared. Stay on your toes. And I think all of the hype about 2012 was simply to misdirect the public. So what the real agenda is of people who like to control things, to do weird stuff, and manipulate weather, manipulate the public, social engineering, whatever they want to do, it's simply a matter of they've got control. They've got control of the military, who controls a lot of the equipment, especially scientific equipment. So there you go. Get ready for 2012. But I don't think it has anything to do with the Mayan calendar or the other phony baloney that's floating around. So at any rate, the main science topic tonight, I will be talking about a little bit about my history of discoveries and some of the time frame when a lot of the disinformation BS came into this field. And then, but the real main science topic, I'll be talking about atmospheric electricity in the planets, and I'm going to kind of run through the planets and give a bit of a detailed bit of information on each of the planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Earth's moon, which is really a planet, and then Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. I'll be lucky to get Saturn in at the end. So I have to keep moving here. There was a story this week, and I like these planted stories. Let me give some other examples before I hit this story. NASA likes to plant these stories about how there's controversy and about the moon landings, especially. A couple weeks ago, the moon rocks were lost, and oh my goodness, that was like, what happened to these moon rocks? And then what else? There's controversy over, I like the one of their favorite ones to pop up with every now and then is that that NASA scientists discovered alien bases on the moon, and that's a big secret, a top secret at NASA, and the astronauts don't want to talk because of that. It's just a lot of phony baloney is what it is. But see, here's the thing. It convinces a lot of people like, oh, wow, there are bases on the moon. And see, that targets a certain crowd, that misinformation piece targets a certain crowd, the people that want to believe in UFOs and aliens and the government is hiding information about aliens. That draws them in, and then as a side effect, convinces them that NASA went to the moon. So at any rate, the latest story is that Apollo 13 commander Jim Lovell has sold for about $340,000, apparently, at an auction. I wish I had some notes that were worth $340,000. But apparently these notes, when they were allegedly Apollo 13, was the disaster happened and they had to find their way back to Earth, he had written some notes in the side of some calculations, some paperwork that NASA had. And I always wondered, how did they get this notebook to the astronauts for him to write the notes on the side of the page when they didn't know that the disaster was going to happen? Well, allegedly. So at any rate, the story is that somehow Jim Lovell had a ring-bound set of notes from NASA. I didn't know they had a printer on the Apollo spacecraft. And so anyway, these NASA notes on how to save the spacecraft were then, he had written in the side columns some notes, and that's why this was so valuable. Somebody bought it for $340,000 or $338,000, something like that. And I think it was sold in English pounds, if I'm not mistaken, but I don't know that whole story. But the point is that NASA loves these controversies. Now, this is a big controversy, and NASA has lawyers saying that, no, he did not have the right to sell this, and it's so in the news. But what does it do? It convinces people that NASA actually went to the moon. And so, at any rate, these stories come out. You see them very frequently now, and it's one of the NASA has to rely on it on its convincing the public that it went to the moon in the Apollo program, because it's the only thing, it's the only laurel it has to sit on or stand on, whatever. So, at any rate, I have a listener question, and I always like listener questions because it shows, first of all, their thinking. And it shows they're digging around for information, and of course they're being somewhat confused by what they see on the internet. So anyway, here's a listener question. It came in on an email just right before Christmas. It said, Jim, could you comment on the reports that magnetic north is moving? Is the rotational axis also changing of the Earth, that is? And then this person says, I've heard one of these poles is moving about 40 miles a year toward Russia. And so then it says, this is a little vague because Russia is rather large. It says, I've also heard of the need to change runway approach magnetic vectors at airports. And then he asks, is the sun setting further south than it was 20 years ago, basically? And so signed the listener. So anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about this and take each point one by one. Okay, is the magnetic north pole moving? And the answer is yes. I do talk about this in my books. I've talked about it on radio shows. And you can find this, you can find a map of the wandering of the magnetic North Pole. This is the point at which if you took compasses and walked around on Earth, they would pretty much all point to this spot. And when you get to that spot, it's like all of the field lines, the magnetic field lines of the Earth, go into the Earth right around that point symmetrically. And so anyway, that's the magnetic North Pole. And it is moving. It's around 40 miles per year. And it moves kind of in a jagged, not too linear motion, but it is migrating up towards the rotational North Pole. Then to answer the question, the second question, is the rotational axis of Earth changing? Well, let me qualify that a little bit. The Earth's rotational axis kind of revolves like a top about every 26,000 years, and it's a precession of the Earth, and that's normal, that's known about. That's because the tilt of the Earth acts like a top. You know how you spin a top, and it goes out on the floor, and it kind of rotates around, and it precesses. That's precession is the term used. And Earth is doing the same thing in the gravitational field of the Sun. So, and there are wobbles because we are also rotating in the gravitational field of the Moon and other planets. So, and then Earth has some internal wobbling that goes on that is very minimal. But the point is that as far as the rotational axis of the Earth changing, apart from these known factors, no, it is not. The magnetic field is independent, I shouldn't say independent, they're somewhat coupled physically. The electrical currents that are in the ionosphere, the electrical currents that are outside of the Earth, couple with Earth's own internal geomagnetic field, which is a magnetic field locked into the Earth's crust. So the permanent magnetic field of the Earth, a lot of people think that when you walk around with a compass that you're measuring the permanent magnetic field of the Earth. And that's partially true. Well, part of what that magnet the compass is reading, now let me just, for those who are really not sure what a compass does, that it has a little needle, and on the tip of one of the needle is balanced on a little balance, and on the tip of one of the ends of the needle is a bit of magnetic material, and that wants to align with the local magnetic field. Okay, so at any rate, what you're measuring with your compass is the local magnetic field. And that is a contribution of the geomagnetic field in a lot of places. Let's take northern Minnesota, for example. The local geomagnetic field has a strong contribution from iron and nickel that's in the surface layers of the earth at those points. So the compass is literally reading the local magnetic field. Now, when there are solar storms, you can actually do this, put a compass on a table, and also you have to make sure there are not magnetic type metals around. For example, compasses have to be adjusted if they're in an airplane or if they're in an automobile. They have to be adjusted so that there's to compensate for the metal that's in the airplane or the car or whatever. But at any rate, the point is that if you took a compass and you set it someplace, and it's measuring the local magnetic field. If there's a solar storm, you can actually see the compass moving based on the effect of that solar storm on the compass down on the surface of the Earth, which means that electrical currents are being driven and changed. And isn't it amazing that modern science denies that these things can happen by magnetic fields, let me point something out, all are created by electrical currents. A permanent magnet in a piece of iron or nickel, or if it's locked in the ground, or if you have a magnet in a motor or whatever, that magnetic field is a result of electrons moving around in the atoms, in the iron atoms or whatever, and they're aligned. And so let me talk about the geomagnetic field. And a lot of this information, by the way, is in my books. I've talked about this, as I say, in past radio shows. But when a permanent magnet, say you have a magnet in your hand, a piece of iron that's magnetic or nickel, whatever, it's magnetic, the way these are made is you create an artificial magnetic field by running electrical currents through wires, and you create an artificial magnetic field. You take the molten iron, you put it in a cast, and let it solidify slowly through what is known as the Curie temperature. The Curie temperature is the temperature at which the atoms solidify into the lattice, into the matrix of the solid metal. And at that point, those magnetic fields are locked there. They're held in place because you've cooled, you've created a solid, but the direction of the magnetic field remains. And that's how you create a permanent magnet. So that indicates that the Earth, which does have a permanent magnet, the core and the surface, wherever that those permanent magnetic fields are locked into the Earth had to have a dynamic external magnetic field driven by electric currents for thousands of years, possibly millions of years, while the Earth cooled through the Curie temperature of the metals, the iron, the nickel, which are the primary carriers of magnetic fields in the Earth. The Earth had to be in a sustained external magnetic field for all of that time. The Earth didn't just magically form these permanent magnets in the Earth. And then there are anomalies. There are places where, for example, there is a fire pit. I like this one of my favorites. In Australia, there's a fire pit that indigenous people used. And the fire pit, of course, melted the iron underneath. It was hot enough to liquefy the iron underneath the fire pit, and the magnetic field of Earth is locked into the opposite direction of the current magnetic field. Okay, so let's go back about 3,500 years to an event where the North Pole of the Earth changed. The physical rotational North Pole of Earth at that time was somewhere around in Canada, in Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan or Wisconsin, somewhere in that area. That was the rotational location of the North Pole, and at the time, the old magnetic field north pole of Earth aligned with that pretty closely. Okay, all of a sudden comes along the Venus comet, thrusts the surface of Earth and changes its rotational direction to where it is now. And this is explained, by the way, very nicely in my Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. There's drawings and explanations of exactly how this happens, the physics of how this happens. But at any rate, the current North Pole of Earth is not where it was 4,000 years ago. That then followed the melting of the Laurentian ice cap, which was mainly on the North American continent, not in Russia at all. And so Russia was more of a tropical climate at the time, semi-tropical. And then, okay, what happened to the magnetic field of Earth? The permanent magnetic field of Earth was over about the location of Ontario north of the state of Michigan. It has been wandering and migrating at about 40 miles per year up to where it is now, and it is continuing to migrate up to the North Pole, which indicates that the current, the magnetic field of Earth is a combination of electrical currents in Earth and permanent magnetic fields, a very complex combination, and combined with the external electrical currents, the Van Allen belts, the electrical currents in the ionosphere, which drive the jet streams, which are electrical currents farther down in the atmosphere, and then the overall geomagnetic field, the plasma magnetic field, which is far out in space. It's about 35,000 miles out into space on the sunward side and extends very far into space on the tail side of Earth, on the non-sunward side of Earth. So this is fairly complex physics, but the end result is that the magnetic North Pole of Earth is migrating, slowly moving, and so when they say it's moving towards Russia, what they really should be saying is it's migrating up to where the North Pole is, which is in the direction of Russia, because Russia is on the other side of the North Pole. So the listeners comment that when somebody says, oh, it's migrating towards Russia, that's really vague, and it's really unscientific. They should be really stating that it's migrating towards the North Pole, the rotational North Pole, but I don't think they want to say that because that raises a question. How is this happening? How come the magnetic field isn't aligned with the North Pole? It should be. Well, that leads to the question, well, if it's moving 40 miles a year in that direction, where was it 4,000 years ago? Well, it was way different, and it was a very different location. And so that brings up, well, why would the magnetic field be thousands of miles away from, or many thousands of miles away from the North Pole? And why is it migrating back there now? It leads out to a whole laundry list of questions. Okay, so at any rate, so would they have to change the runway approach vectors to for airlines? And the answer is yes. But basically, by the time airlines are landing, they're using GPS, they're using a lot of other information that wasn't available many years ago. So airlines don't depend on strictly a compass anymore to fly with. But at any rate, I'm not sure if that would require what they're doing in terms of changing the magnetic field mapping for airlines. But and then the last question, is the sun setting further south than it was 20 years ago? Nope, the sun is pretty much on target. Those are major changes that would have to take place, and the Earth doesn't just jump up and change, and the moon and the sun and the orbits of the planets and the spin axis, those things don't just jump up and change on their own. And this is the dichotomy of standard science. You can see many of these things. There were magnetic alterations in the Earth's magnetic field throughout history, and some not so long ago, but standard science has no way of accounting for this because they say nothing has happened to Earth for millions and billions of years. It's been the same, so they have no way of accounting for this, so they have to make up a lot of nursery rhyme fairy tale science to try and account for it. So anyway, that was a good question. That leads to a lot of other questions. And let's see, a couple other stories here. this one I have to laugh at too. Another failed mission to Mars. The Russian Phoebus, was it the Grunt program? I believe it is called. But anyway, Russia's attempt to go to Mars has failed. And now if you look at the history of people trying to get to Mars, pretty much everybody has gotten to the moon that tried to get to the moon. I can just about guarantee you that our boys in blue are preventing anybody from getting to Mars. If you look at the history, this would be, and I know every time this happens I talk about it, it would be good to go in and do a real history, a real study on the attempted failures of everybody, except the U.S., of course, to get to Mars. The Mars probes, the U.S. has had many. There was a Russian probe a number of years ago. It actually got about halfway to Mars, and then it just magically disappeared. Went off the radar, and nobody heard from it since. This one, they managed to stop before it ever got any place. Remember that it was going to come back to Earth, and it had some pretty bad chemicals on it. Well, now it is actually coming into the atmosphere, I believe, let's see, within the next couple of days, they think, within about 3 or 4 days, it should enter Earth's atmosphere. But I noticed that no one is talking about the chemicals that are on this spacecraft, or other bad things. They think that it's going to burn up in the upper atmosphere, but a lot of times these the chemicals, etc., are in pretty solid containers, so they may get all the way down to the surface of the Earth, and they don't really know where this thing might land. So at any rate, that's coming in the next few days. I'll try and report on that next week. Here's something. I wanted to thank those people who purchased from the webpage. Just a thank you, because that makes this show possible. It makes the other things that happen possible, and just shows support. Plus, people get a very good return on it. I never take donations. I don't accept freebies, so to speak. I always give something in return for what people, but also something very valuable. The books, the CDs, the DVDs, the educational material. You know, there are a lot of people, I should say, not just a lot, but a lot of people who are educating their kids using my books and information. So that's a pretty big classroom out there. And, you know, it's wonderful to see a generation of kids growing up with real science, real information, and learning how to discern at a young age the garbage that is presented in the public schools or the standard textbooks, even if they're going to private schools, all the way up to the PhD level. From kindergarten to PhD, the people are being programmed with garbage science, with garbage information. And learning how to discern that at a young age is just wonderful. We should have one of those "just say no" campaigns to just say no to garbage science. Just think of all of the ridiculous fairy tale science that's being pawned off on kids these days, and their parents think, well, the kids are going to school, that must be good information. It's coming from NASA. Gee, that must be the top science agency. Look at all those scientists that work for NASA. And they don't have any clue that it's simply garbage when they listen to the evening news, when they listen to the weather report, that the National Weather Service has no clue what causes weather. The only reason they can predict weather is they have computer modeling that uses extrapolations based on past weather patterns. That's what allows them to predict weather, but a lot of times they can't predict the weather more than a day in advance. 2 days in advance, forget it. It used to be they could predict the temperatures out about a week, and the temperatures at least were pretty good, but they can't even get the temperature right at the current time anymore. So anyway, back to the failed Russian mission. to Mars, just one in a long list of failures to the planet Mars from the various countries, Japan, European Space Agency, England. They've all tried to go there with special probes. Russia has landed on Mars, but something funny about Mars. They just don't want people getting there. And here's what appears to be the case, that before the Venus event, Mars, and Velikovsky talks about this in his books, it's very clear that Mars was a blue planet, a water planet with a thick atmosphere. Now it's a dust planet, it's a dust bowl, and it has about 1% of the atmosphere of Earth. Very interestingly enough, it has the atmosphere of a comet. It basically had its atmosphere robbed by the large passing comet, and the ancients saw this. They saw the large electrical discharges, the snaking discharges extending out from the comet as the comet went by. And the comet nucleus, my books, by the way, talk about this too. The comet had a much higher surface gravity than the planet Mars, and so it basically, once that electrical connection was there, it gave a free path for the atmosphere and then the oceans of Mars to follow. So that's what you see left over today. But there again, standard science. They go up and they see this, and they see the impeccably fresh riverbeds and the erosion on Mars. How could that still be there when Mars has tremendous dust storms every year? This would all have been eroded if it were millions of years ago, and they're fresh as a daisy. So it's very clear that all of this happened very recent, within very recent times. But standard science, as I said, has no way to account for this, so they give the fairy tale science, and every time NASA goes to search for water, it's predetermined that they're going to say, oh, this was billions of years ago, and they can always get a group of PhD scientists to get up and say that, because basically they don't know any better, and number two, their paycheck depends on it. Their ability to be that scientist depends on them being a tier two know-nothing scientist. And so they can promote that. I'll be talking, in when I the main science topic, I'll be talking about atmospheric electricity. And a couple weeks ago, I talked about the 14th International Scientific Convention on Atmospheric Electricity, a group of tier two scientists that for 14 years have been getting together to try and figure out atmospheric electricity, and are still talking about ice particles bumping together to cause electricity in the atmosphere. It's just ludicrous, tier two, pretend fairy tale science. But 14 years, and these people still have no clue at all what is going on out there. So, at any rate, why is the Mars mission failing? Well, what else was going on Mars? It appears that there was very advanced civilizations, that there was space travel between Earth and Mars and possibly other places, so that there is a remnant of civilizations on Mars, and they don't want to talk about that. Let's talk about an ancient discovery, not too ancient, but back when Columbus discovered, as one of the discoverers of the New World. Remember that when the Vikings discovered the New World hundreds of years before Columbus, they encountered the Inuits, that were a fearsome tribe. Everybody thought the Vikings were bad. No, the Inuits, man, they would clean house right now. They didn't like the Vikings because the Vikings were moving into their territory. But the Inuits were bad, group of people. But then the point is that the Vikings discovered and made note of the Inuits. When Columbus came across and came down through the Caribbean, he discovered the Arawaks, the Indian tribes that populated the Antilles Islands and the Puerto Rico, and some of the bigger islands were very populated at the time. And those populations have somewhat been absorbed into the current populations of Puerto Rico. And by the way, I should mention that there is still a core remnant of the Inuits in existence today, although sociologists tend to say that no, they've been absorbed completely, and that's really not true. There are groups of fairly pure strains of Inuits throughout the Caribbean still. But at any rate, the current population, the bulk of the current population of, say, Puerto Rico and Cuba and Santo Domingo, were a combination of the slave trade that came in from Africa, from the Spanish that came across, and the Inuits, the local Indian populations. And this is true of the northern part of South America, too, the Caribbean coasts of South America, that those populations are a combination. There are some places where there are much higher concentration of the remnants of the African slave trade, like Jamaica or like Haiti. And so at any rate, the point is that the discoverers of that time found flourishing populations at that time. And of course, South America had probably hundreds of millions of natives living there. When Magellan came around the tip of South America, they sailed along the coastline, south along South America, and then sailed up the western coastline of the Pacific. And there were millions of people there. They call it Tierra del Fuego, the point of South America, because of all of the campfires up in the mountains that the Magellan saw when he came around there. That's why it's named Tierra del Fuego. It's the point of fires. Huge populations. But now let's talk about what if NASA had a proposal to discover these new worlds today. This would all be kept secret, and the population would be kept in Europe, and we would not know about these populations because it would be considered top secret for the governments. Because if the people realized that there were all of these indigenous populations there, then they'd go, well, how could there be indigenous populations there if all of the populations came from the Indus Valley, you know, or the Mesopotamia, or, you know, those stories simply did not add up. They wouldn't make sense. But they didn't know enough to cover up that information at the time. And by the way, when Columbus sailed to the New World, there were a lot of people that had an inkling that there was something there. But at any rate, that's a whole other story. But the point is that when the Russian Phoebus Grunt mission failed, it was very clear to me, and I knew from the very inception, that this thing would never get to Mars, because there are groups of people who don't want that information. The Russians are not controllable. They're not in the program. NASA is very controllable. The Tier 2 science structure is set up. The Tier 1 science, the secret science that sits above NASA, is all very much in place and very controllable, but Russia is not. It's kind of like a loose cannon, so they can't allow Russia to go to Mars and say, hey, look at all the remnants of these civilizations that are there. The word would get out, I believe. So anyway, that's the story, one more failed Mars mission. Just one other quick comment. This is the first week in quite a long time, going back to October before, where we have not had, this is the first week in which we have not had a comet come in from the south and basically hit the sun or come very close to the sun. The first week in a very long time. So just that's worthy of note. And of course, I've talked about the various comets that have come in from the south, not the least of which is Comet Lovejoy. And all of the NASA hiding of information and the bad science that revolves around the reporting of these incidents. Okay, so on to the main science topic. The main science topic, atmospheric electricity in the planets. And let me just reiterate quickly that standard science has a very strange hodgepodge of scientific concepts. If you go to scientific meetings today, like I do, there might be 15 to 20,000 scientists there that deal with atmospheric conditions, and these fields overlap. They might be planetary scientists, they might be astronomers, they might be, from any other field, they might be geologists, but a lot of it comes back to atmospheric electricity. The geologists right now around the world are realizing that atmospheric electricity has a lot to do, or it's related to volcanic activity or earthquakes also, something that I've talked about for a long time, what the relationships are there. And not all volcanoes, not all earthquakes have definite relationships with the atmosphere. Some have more of a relationship than others. You can see on some major solar flaring, some of them have to do, can cause effects in the surface of the Earth, in the geology of the Earth. The point is, atmospheric electricity has a lot to do with a lot of the other fields, not the least of which is biological evolution, the evolution of plants, the evolution of animals, and of which man is one. So at any rate, it's very interesting to see, as I said, I talked about the last summer in Brazil in August of 2011, the 14th International Conference on Atmospheric Electricity held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And how that for 14 years, these scientists are absolutely clueless. And these are people that are from the major universities in the United States and around the world, and they're still talking about electric fields and thunderclouds being caused by ice particles bumping together. And how does this create a battery so you have electricity shooting out the top of the cloud, out the bottom of the cloud, and to the energies above the clouds, sometimes as much as gamma rays, extremely high energy electromagnetic radiation, X-ray activity. How does this happen by little ice particles bumping into each other, creating a battery, and then somehow electricity shooting out both sides of this battery? It's just fairy tale, ridiculous science. And I've been at meetings with some of these people, and they're indignant about it, that, oh, yes, that, for example, let's look at atmospheric electricity above volcanoes. It's shooting out of the clouds above volcanoes and arcing down to the earth. It's arcing up to the sky. How does a battery that forms in that cloud shoot electricity out of the cloud? I remember an incident. I was at a international scientific meeting one time. It was down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I had some young PhD candidates, they had already received their PhDs, and they were just beginning to come to the U.S. to their first scientific meetings. And they were being shuttled around, or guided around, I should say, by a NASA scientist. And kind of, they hover around these people. They don't want them to talk. They certainly don't want them talking to me. So at any rate, I was explaining a picture that was on my poster regarding atmospheric electricity around the Chilean volcanoes that were happening at the time, and that you could see the electricity coming out. And I pointed out that batteries don't shoot electricity out from the battery. If there's no electrical path given for around the battery, then they will discharge internally, so there's no mechanism for lightning to shoot or electricity to shoot out of a battery, no matter what the formation process is that you claim inside the battery. And the students were like, yeah, that makes sense. And I remember the NASA lead scientist, who was probably 40-some years old, was indignant. Oh no, this has been well proven, and this is electricity that's caused in the cloud itself. And I'm like, buddy, and none of his students, the fresh PhD students, none of the fresh students believed him, which I thought was interesting. And they said, no, it can't happen. And here are young students. And he got really, really mad. And he started trying to get them away from me, because right there, it was cracking the nut. It was breaking open the egg of knowledge for these students. And, they did not want these students listening to me. So at any rate, as I said, standard science clueless, but what is the real story? Let's start with the source of all of this. What if we didn't have the sun and the electrical conditions coming out of the sun? Well, there wouldn't be any electricity, atmospheric electricity on Earth. On the other planets, Jupiter and Saturn would have atmospheric electricity because they are small fusion stars in their own right. They have their own local source of electrical energy because their atmospheres are very similar to the Sun. They have low levels of fusion in their atmosphere, which, by the way, solves the problem of low-level fusion, how to control fusion on a controlled basis. It's just like an engine, any other engine. You have a spark plug that can ignite the fusion, and then it dissipates, and it's on a controlled basis. So you could basically reproduce the atmosphere of Jupiter or Saturn, basically a helium, hydrogen, helium combination. By the way, those atmospheres, the atmosphere of Jupiter is very similar to that of the Sun. But the or Saturn is very similar also, and these generate a good deal of energy. It's well known Jupiter produces about 2 times the amount of energy that it receives from the Sun, and Saturn is producing about 3 times. So how can Saturn, which is smaller, produce more energy for its size than Jupiter? Well, that's because it's newer. Saturn is a newer, more active planet. With the ring system, Jupiter's ring system is fairly faded. It has a much bigger moon system, which disrupts the ring systems. And it's very clear that the moons of Jupiter are much older. Saturn has some very young moons, Titan being the very young moon of Saturn, with basically lakes and oceans of nitrogen and possibly other petrol type, the hydrocarbons in its atmosphere. So the condition on Titan is very young. You see a lot of the moons in the solar system are very young. But what about atmospheric electricity? Where does it really come from? Well, all of the planets sit in the solar capacitor. The Sun is basically a battery. It's creating a battery by the fusion in the Sun kicks out a proton wind. There's a higher level of proton current in the solar wind than electrons, and that moves out across the solar system, out to the far edges of the solar system. It maintains a cloud of dust and gas at the far end of the edge of the solar system, which is ionized, and that creates a battery. Everything inside that is discharging that solar capacitor. Just like the bug that enters the electrostatic bug killer, the mosquito bug killer that sits in your backyard, where there's a neon light in the middle that attracts the bug, and once the bug gets in the electrical plates, zap, the electrical current moves along the path of the bug. It's not going to discharge. It's set so it's not going to discharge at any other than if there is a bug in there. So the bug flies in, zap, the electrical discharge zaps the bug, and the bug falls down dead into a tray at the bottom, and is waiting for the next bug to fly in there. So why does the discharge always occur along the path of the bug? Well, that's because when the bug comes in, the outside metal screen is at ground potential. That bug comes in at ground potential as he moves in towards the high voltage plate in the middle. He's at ground potential. What does that discharge want to do? It's going to seek and discharge towards that ground that's sticking out like a point out of the ground, and it's adjusted so that the at atmospheric pressure and the type of atmosphere on Earth, that bug killer, the two plates, are not going to discharge. In the case of the solar capacitor, it builds up to the level of a certain level, and then it has to start bringing back a return current. And that return current sheet, I've already identified one of the major return current sheets, and that comes back to the Sun, where Earth is in the month of August. And so that's why we have the peak hurricane season, the peak tornado season, the peak aurora season, all occur centered around the month of August. It can occur as early as June or as late as November, but centered around the month of August. There's that return current sheet coming back from the far edges of the solar system. So that's one of the factors that I look for when I'm trying to predict weather. And weather events, also the planets, if two planets align electrically along their electrical discharges align, say Jupiter and Earth, or Mars and Earth, or Venus and Earth, or Venus and Jupiter, and say their moons also align, those can be trigger points. Or Earth's moon, if it moves in front of the Earth, between Earth and the Sun, and then it moves away, that causes a jolt in that electrical discharge and can trigger certain events. All of these things have factors in electrical conditions on the planets. So say, for example, little Mercury comes around, aligns with Venus. It can cause a very significant electrical effects at Venus or on Mercury when these events occur. Venus, all of these planets have magnetic tails, what they're called magnetic tails, but really they're basically comet tails. They're the same situation as a comet. Earth has little comet tails attaching to it all the time, especially in the form of water, H2O. And H2O is one of the main constituents of comet tails. So Earth, being in the center of the inner solar system, has access to a lot of water. We see in storm conditions, which are driven by these electrical currents from outside of the planet, we see water attaching into the upper atmosphere, and it's actually measurable from spacecraft in outer space. They see the water coming into the upper atmosphere, and scientists don't know why. They think, oh, well, little ice balls must be coming into the atmosphere and break up, but that's not the signature that they're seeing. They're seeing a broad area that all of a sudden has water way up in the upper atmosphere, in the ionosphere, and then it dissipates. So at any rate, the situation is as follows. Every planet and moon, and all the way down to dust particles, all of them are discharging the solar capacitor. A lot of times at scientific meetings, I am able to sit there and listen to scientists discussing things. And one time, some of the NASA scientists were sitting around, and we were kind of in a group, and one of them brought up the fact that they had sent up, I think it was barium trace particles from a satellite. They let them go from a satellite, and they wanted to see what was going to happen to the barium. It was like a trace. They wanted to see them. And the purpose of the experiment was simply to see what happened to these barium atoms as they dissipated and moved in the stream of particles that surrounds Earth. There's a very thin atmosphere up there, and it's all moving, and they wanted to kind of trace where this atmosphere is moving. That was the purpose. But what did they see? They saw the barium atoms on the sunward side all became electrified. And they were going, how come these electric fields are being set up around all of these barium particles of, like, very small dust particles of barium? And, well, it's very obvious. They're all discharging the solar capacitor. In the case of Earth, they're in the local Earth environment, electric fields, and they're discharging the local capacitors. In my weather book, I go through, I believe there's 17 different local batteries that I've identified around Earth. In the Diamond Principle book, I show how these can be used with properly designed spacecraft as a form of propulsion to move spacecraft away from Earth orbit and out into interplanetary space for basically for free, and how these electrical currents that are set up because of the fusion in stars and the current paths, the paths between stars because of the fusion in the galactic nucleus, you have the same situation. You have electrical currents passing down the arms of the galaxy. And so you can ride these electrical currents. Back in 1982, I gave a talk, and I called these the electrical currents to the stars. And so that name stuck, and I also have a video, a special video, that I made back in early 2000s. I gave a talk at the one of the international UFO conferences on space propulsion, and I talked about, and there was a whole host of NASA scientists there, I talked about the electric rivers to the stars, the electric highways to the stars, I call them, and the electrical currents and how you can ride these with spacecraft to go to the other stars and to move around the solar system. But at any rate, it is all powered, whether you're on Mercury, Jupiter, Mars, Earth's moon. By the way, a couple weeks ago, I gave a gave a discussion of electrodynamic surface features on our moon. They're like little whirlwinds of dust that are there, and they're just like little circular patterns, whirlwind patterns of dust on the moon. And the scientists can't figure out what's causing these, and they go, oh, that's solar wind. Well, by the time the solar wind gets to Earth, it's very homogenized, let's put it that way. It's not in little whirlwinds that are on a small scale on the surface of the moon. These are definitely basically little tornadoes that are on the surface of the moon, just like Mars has tornadoes. This is something I discussed. Remember back, I forget when it was, back in the 90s when NASA took a picture of Mars, and lo and behold, there's a hurricane raging at the one of the North Poles, I believe it is the North Pole of Mars, and a full-blown hurricane, yet there are no oceans on Mars. So how do hurricanes form on Mars? Standard scientific theory says that hurricanes form from warm water. Well, there ain't no warm water on Mars, and there ain't no oceans on Mars. There's no water, surface water at all. And if there is any, it's in very small quantities. And so how do you get a hurricane forming up at the North Pole of Mars in a thin atmosphere? Well, it's electrical. And so it's just one of the factors that tells you that the standard science of hurricanes is all wet. It doesn't make sense that warm water or salt content in water somehow enhances, or global warming enhances hurricanes. No, has absolutely nothing to do with hurricane formation. But you will find all the standard magazines, Discover, Astronomy, all of them, even, you know, like Physics Today, all of these magazines purporting bad Tier 2 science. And you have fleets, I mean, tens of thousands of scientists, meteorologists, atmospheric scientists that have absolutely no clue what is going on, if they draw a paycheck. So at any rate, let's go to Mercury. Little Mercury really does not have much of an atmosphere. It recently found out that, yes, it has an atmosphere, and it has some very dynamic processes in that atmosphere. It is the closest planet to the Sun, and therefore has the most active comet-like conditions of basically of any of the planet. Interesting fact is that in terms of the gravitational momentum of all of the planets, Mercury, the little planet Mercury, holds the majority of the angular momentum of all of the planets, including Jupiter. And why is that? Because it moves very fast around the Sun. It's close to the Sun. But at any rate, it's a very interesting property. It has more angular momentum than the planet Jupiter. So very strange how these things work. But that's one thing you learn when you're in physics. You learn a lot of these properties and what the real situation is. That's why, by the way, you go on the internet and you'll see, I just saw another one. Somebody sent me one, a YouTube video. Some clown is out there talking about the Egyptian pyramids being Tesla energy gatherers, and it just goes into this long, contorted, completely incorrect discussion of piezoelectricity and something about the type of limestone used in the construction. Complete garbage science. And by the way, the wannabes that want to copy my work, a lot of this is controlled by government disinformation, and it has two purposes. One is to turn real scientists away from these topics, and number two, to mislead the unsuspecting public. And it's successful. I mean, this one particular video was quite long, professionally produced, very professionally, very glossy. I use the term glossy just like a glossy magazine, very highly professionally produced information. And and just going into all of this contorted, ridiculous, bad scientific explanations. And the key, of course, is that you don't know who put this out. Who's doing this? There's no name associated with this. And it clearly has mixed in a lot of my work, which I point out how the Egyptian pyramids very likely were used as Tesla towers, not due to piezoelectricity, but due to the gathering of atmospheric electricity. And, you know, so the basic point is these videos, these web pages are meant to distort the real the subject. Why? As I said, it does two things. It takes real scientists and turns them away. They don't want to have anything to do with this. And the real immature tier two scientist looks at this and goes, ah, then they mix it, all of this stuff together. And one of the rules of my work is you cannot mix my work with that of other people, with standard science, with crackpot science. And people are constantly falling into that trap because they don't know any better. But that's the purpose of misinformation. That's why there are web pages that spend daily trying to copy my work and distort it with a bunch of crackpots running around trying to pretend they're scientists when they're not. Why? Because then the disinformation crew can put that all in one bundle, try and include me and say, oh, look at all of that ridiculous science. It's all a bunch of foolishness. The standard scientists won't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and it misleads the public. What a good combination. So at any rate, let's look at Venus. Venus has a constant X-ray cloud in front of it on the sunward side. That's what basically due to the electron current that's coming in on the sunward side, it collides with the atoms and molecules that are out in basically a comet tail on the sunward side of Venus and creates X-rays. This is something that X-ray signature is exactly the same as you would see with a comet. It has been discovered, and that was one of my main predictions of comets to set it, my theory apart from the dirty snowball comet model, was that in front of the comet nucleus, you should see a cloud of electrons. It was discovered in 1996 in one of the top scientific discoveries of that year. But of course, NASA came along with some ridiculous fairy tale science to describe it, even though they had never heard about it. They had no idea why it was caused. Yet NASA comes along and gives this ridiculous scientific explanation. Of course, they don't want to talk about the real answer because it leads up to too many questions. Well, I'm about out of time this week. Remember to go to the webpage, and once again, I want to thank all of the people who purchased from the webpage. You receive something valuable, and you keep this show going. So thank you over past years. It's just wonderful to see this. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.